Psalm 50, that was our psalm today. This is not a psalm that is very well known. We don't preach on it or teach on it very often. But it is a very instructive psalm for us, because what the psalmist tries to do in the psalm is he tries to teach us what true worship looks like. In the psalm, the psalmist imagines God coming down from heaven to judge the worship that's occurring in the temple at that time. And what God does, and we'll see this when we look at the psalm, is first, he names the things that the people are doing wrong. But then secondly, God gives them a new way to worship him, a way that will draw them closer to him, bless them with the life that he wants to give them. And so today, what I want to do is I want us just to walk through the psalm to see how it might inform our worship. Because, of course, we want to draw closer to God. We want to be blessed with the life that he wants to give. So, again, we'll walk through the psalm. You may want to look at your bulletin as we do this. It may be helpful. But this is how the psalm begins, verses 1 through 3. The Lord, the God of gods, has spoken. He has called the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, perfect in its beauty, God reveals himself in glory. Our God will come and will not keep silence. Before him there is consuming flame, and round about him a raging storm. So, again, the psalm begins, and the psalmist imagines God coming down out of heaven. And the first thing that we see is our God is a holy God. Before him, there is a consuming flame, and round about him, a raging storm. One of the first mistakes we can make when we approach God in worship is we can have a view of him that is too small. I think all of us, I do this, all of us tend to cut down God to size. We mold, we shape him by our desires, our needs. We make him safe so that we can pretend to be in control. But here the psalmist reminds us that God is other. God is holy. The writer Annie Dillard, in her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, she has a great little section where she talks about worship in the church, and she writes this. She's talking about what we do on Sunday morning. She says, "Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we are invoking? It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews, for the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense, or the waking God may draw us out to where we can never return." God is holy. We cannot domesticate God. And so the psalmist reminds us of the one that we're approaching. He continues, verse 4. He, God, calls the heavens and the earth from above to witness the judgment of his people. Gather before me my loyal followers, those who have made a covenant with me and sealed it with sacrifice. Let the heavens declare the rightness of his cause, for God himself is judge. So the scene here with God descending, it's the scene of a courtroom. And God calls the heavens and the earth to witness his accusations, the accusations he's going to make against his people for the way they're worshiping. And by the way, the fact that God can call and command the heavens and the earth, it speaks again to his power. So the court is in session. The heavens and the earth are there to witness. And God says to his people, "You must reckon with me. I come to you as a judge. Not a judge of hell and damnation, but a judge who reminds us that before him we have a lot to sort out. And we have a lot of questions to answer, questions that go to the very bottom of our lives." And so then God, as he sits in the seat of the judge, he speaks and he says, Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, I will bear witness against you, for I am God, your God. Now notice here, and this is important, God in the psalm, he isn't just speaking to anyone, he is speaking to his people. Right? These are the people he loves, the people he calls, the people he sends out. In the first thing he says to his people, the first word that he utters in verse 7 is, hear. It's a command. Another way to translate it is, listen. Hear, O my people, and I will speak. God, the psalmist reminds us, wants us to hear, to listen. This word for hear is a very important word in the Old Testament. It's the word Shema. It's sort of foundational to the Jewish faith. The earliest prayer that children learn in the Jewish life is the Shema. It's Deuteronomy 6:4. The Shema says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is God alone. And the imperative there that they are to learn from an early age is to hear, to listen. Right? Worship of God begins when we listen, when we turn off our cell phones and we start to pay attention. Now, once they are listening, God begins to speak his accusations against the people. They come in two sections. First section starts with verse 8. God says, I do not accuse you because of your sacrifices. Your offerings are always before me. I will take no bull calf from your stalls, nor he-goats out of your pens, for all the beasts of the forest are mine, the herds and their thousands upon the hills. I know every bird in the sky, and the creatures of the fields are in my sight. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the whole world is mine and all that is in it. Do you think I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Now, what is God saying here in this first accusation? Well, he's talking about the nature of our relationship with him. In almost all our human relationships, there is a give and take. I give to you, you give back to me. Right? I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Healthy human relationships are partnerships like this. There's a little giving, there's a little taking. And we can forget that our relationship with God is not like this. As a priest, sometimes when things are not going well for me or something bad happens, I automatically tend to think, come on, God, I'm a priest. I've given my life to serve you, right? Can't you cut me some slack? Don't I deserve a few favors? But of course, I don't deserve any favors from God. At its worst, when we think like this, we can try to manipulate God. We can try to impress him. We can try to earn his favor. And then we demand his favor. And so God says to us here in this psalm, I don't need you. And I don't need your gifts. These animals, the animals that they were bringing to the temple to try to impress God, to win his favor, God says, guess what? These animals, they're already mine. So stop thinking that you're special for giving me something I already have. You cannot bribe me with your self-serving worship. And you see, that's the accusation, that the people are coming to God, in a sense, to bribe him, to earn his favor. And God says, that's not how this works. That's not what worship looks like. So the second accusation then begins at verse 16. And at the beginning here, the translation makes it seem like this is a different group of people. It's the same group of people. And here, God calls the people wicked. So why does God call them wicked? Well, they're wicked because they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. They're not listening. They're not obeying. verses 16 and 17. But to the wicked, God says, why do you recite my statutes and take my covenant upon your lips, since you refuse discipline and toss my words behind your back? They are wicked because they live lives on their own terms, not on the terms of the holy God. Verse 18, when you see a thief, you make him your friend, and you cast in your lot with adulterers. They're wicked because they don't value others. They talk dishonestly and cheaply about their neighbors, even their own family members. Verses 19 and 20, you have loosed your lips for evil and harnessed your tongue to a lie. You were always speaking evil of your brother and slandering your own mother's son. So basically, the wicked are those who pretend to be God's people. They show up for worship. They know all the right things to say. They bring gifts to God that they think are going to make him happy. And yet, ultimately, they don't live their lives in the way that God calls them to live. I mean, ultimately, they are refusing to follow him. So, those are the accusations. And the truth is, they're hard to hear. Because if we're honest with ourselves, all of us, to some degree, are guilty of these accusations. And yet we have to remember that when God speaks these words, he's not speaking them just to condemn, but rather he is speaking them to remind his people. To remind them that you can't substitute religious performance for obedience. An obedience that loves God and loves your neighbor. He's calling them back to him. And so what he does is he brackets this rebuke with an alternative way to worship, an alternative way to live. So he brackets the accusation with this alternative. And he speaks it twice so that we don't miss it. Verses 14 and 15 and then verse 24. This is what he says, 14 and 15. Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and make good your vows to the Most High. Call on me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you and you shall glorify me. And then, 24. Whoever offers me the sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me. But to those who keep in my way, I will show the salvation of God. The term that shows up twice there, and is the key term, is sacrifice of thanksgiving. That's what God wants. And when we hear that, it means more than just coming to God with a thankful heart. It means more than just a feeling. The phrase, it refers to a regular component of worship in ancient Israel. It refers to the thank offering. And the thank offering was composed of both a material offering and a verbal statement naming that for which you were thankful. And what God is saying is that the only sacrifice he wants is a demonstration of our gratitude. What pleases God is when we acknowledge our dependence on his gifts and then we offer those gifts back to him. Now, the Israelites, they would have understood this. Their God, the God of Exodus, had brought them out of slavery. Without him, they would still be in Egypt. And if they were in Egypt, they were as good as dead. But God had given them a new life after slavery, a second life, not earned, but a life that was pure gift, a life of freedom, a life of abundance. And because this was a gift, they didn't have to guard it. They didn't have to hold on to it. Rather, they could live with a new abandonment. They could be generous and give of themselves. Not to get something in return, not so that God would owe them, but so that they could give in thanksgiving. And that's like us. As Christians, we know about despair. We know about having no hope. We know about emptiness. We know how life is so short. And then, because of the God of Easter, we find that we've been given a new life, a life of joy, a life after death. And when you live this second life, the one you didn't earn, the one that's pure gift, you can give and keep giving until you give it away. One writer puts it this way: in contrast to the wicked who live distorted lives of self-deception, we are given the image of gratitude, the gratitude of generous gifts, given to God, given to the church, offered to the neighbor, given to the poor, given in charity, given for justice, given in policy, given in the neighborhood. Money, time, energy, love, justice, caring, bodily investment, all given because all is gift. Two ways to worship. Two ways to live. One way leads to God, the other leads away from Him. Whoever offers me the sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me. And to those who keep in my way, I will show the salvation of God. Amen.